Hello and welcome to the Journal of Democracy podcast. I'm Brent Kalmer, managing editor of the Journal. Today we're joined by Professor Nathan Brown, and we're going to speak about his article, Egypt's Failed Transition, which appears in the October 2013 issue of the Journal of Democracy. And I should note, this piece appears as a free download at our website, which is journalofdemocracy.org. So if you're perplexed by what has been going on in Egypt, you would definitely want to go over and check that out. A word about Professor Brown. He is professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, and he is a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So, Professor Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to read you a brief quote from near the beginning of your piece, and then maybe we could get you to expand on this a bit. You write that, quote, the immediate problems in Egypt can be traced not to voting as such, but to the choices of the main political actors, and that at a still deeper level, anyone seeking to grasp what went wrong in Egypt must reckon with the persistence of underlying authoritarian patterns, as well as a transition process dating from 2011 that was, in actuality, neither a real process nor anything that provided for a real transition, unquote. So is it fair to say that most actors of the post-Mubarak and now the post-Morsi eras are in some sense still playing by the old authoritarian rules?
In some sense, yes. I mean, not everybody is playing entirely by electoral rules. For instance, when the opposition coalition, the one that eventually overthrew Morsi, felt that they had very widespread support, they brought their supporters into the streets for demonstrations. They sought to get the support of the judiciary, the military, the security apparatus, and so on, and they successfully overthrew Morsi, essentially through mass uprising and coup rather than through democratic procedures. There's other kinds of ways in which the older authoritarian patterns still exist. The way that military and the security services operate outside of mechanisms of democratic accountability, and so on. That said, I do think that there are a couple important differences between Egypt in 2013 or late 2013 and Egypt under Mubarak when it was much more full and obviously authoritarian. In the first place, I think that there will still be some meaningful democratic process that is about to get underway, where you'll have a referendum on the constitution, parliamentary elections where nobody knows the outcome in advance, and a presidential election, which we still don't even know who's going to actually be running. So you will have democratic mechanisms, electoral mechanisms, that will have some impact on politics. And the second difference, I think, that's important between Egyptian politics as it's emerging now and that which as it operated under Mubarak, is that under Mubarak there was a single structure, the presidency, which when push came to shove could control anything in Egyptian political life. And I'm not sure that exists anymore. Obviously the military is in the driver's seat, the security apparatus is very strong, but it looks to me like it's going to be a little bit more of a decentralized kind of political system that will emerge, not one that has any central ultimate address.
Now there's a confusion, I think, surrounding the issue of the constitution, because this was one of the first things that people heard about after Mubarak's fall. This seemed to be kind of a touchstone for the transition, something that people could look to as guiding, as showing the way forward. But it sounds like the generals established this kind of tiny ad hoc committee to create a constitutional framework by amending the 1971 constitution. And those amendments were then subsequently rolled into this March 2011 constitutional declaration, whose authors were unknown to the public. So help us make sense of this. It seems like a very opaque process, one that was almost custom made to kind of create suspicion and almost paranoia among the various groups. How did this play out?
I think it did. You know, an awful lot of the things that went wrong in the Egyptian transition can be attributed to some basic decisions that were made at the very beginning. And Egyptians speculated at the time and continue to speculate about exactly why those decisions were made the way that they were. This tiny ad hoc committee, for instance, that suggested changes in the 1971 constitution contained one member from the Muslim Brotherhood. It contained Tariq al-Bishri, a prominent intellectual who had Islamist inclinations. He was a former judge. And so people looked at that and said, aha, there's some kind of hidden deal between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood. and try to interpret everything sort of through that lens. My own understanding of the decisions that were made fairly early on, if you're talking about the couple months after Mubarak's overthrow, really probably looked a little bit more like Keystone Cops than they looked like Dr. Evil sort of manipulating things behind the scenes. There were certain givens. I mean, the military was acting essentially as overseeing the process. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces was sitting in the position of president, essentially, and in a place where there was no parliament and so on. So it essentially had unlimited power, but they also clearly wanted a very quick transition. So an awful lot of the speed and the limited nature of the amendments that they were looking at, a lot of those I think had to do with just the military's concern to hold the state together, presumably to hold the military's place within the state, but also to ensure that the revolution didn't continue or deepen. It wasn't necessarily any kind of grand design to move the country in any particular direction. What that had the effect of doing, this constitutional process, was empowering elections as a way of determining who was going to be writing the rules. So you had a constitutional referendum in March, which the military got behind these constitutional amendments, and the Islamists got behind it again because they were interested in pushing the process forward. That required the election of a parliament. So that parliament was elected. The Islamists did even better than people expected, with the Muslim Brotherhood and Salafis and other Islamists completely dominating both the upper house and the lower house. And that put them in the position of being able to designate who was going to write what they thought was going to be the country's permanent constitution, because of the process that had been designed back in March, which had the parliament decide who was going to be writing this constitution. So it looked like a process that was designed to serve the military's interests, and it was designed to serve the Islamist interests. And I think it did serve the military's interests, and I think it did serve the Islamist interests. But if you go back to that original period, nobody expected the Islamists to do as well as they expected. I've talked to some members of this ad hoc committee that worked in February and March to draft these amendments, and they say that they got very little guidance from the military about precisely how to proceed. And so it begins to look a little bit more like an ad hoc process, one which sort of broke a certain way as much by accident as by design. But the result was that in 2012, the Islamists, it's clear, are going to dominate any kind of process in Egypt that has any kind of a democratic nature. They're simply the ones who are going to be winning all the elections, and that really I think begins to work its effects on the kinds of suspicions among various Egyptian political actors about the way that people begin to regard the parliament, the constitutional process, and so on.
And yet there seems to be a bit of a paradox here, because as you point out in the piece, and this is another apropos quote, a revolution that is carried out in the people's name is unlikely to be able to keep them out of the voting booths for long. So there is clearly this imperative to have people at the polls, and yet there is this sense that Islamists will become so dominant that they would potentially alter the course of history. How could that have been balanced in a way that might not have led to what we see today? Or could it have been?
I think it could have been, but it was politically very difficult. Back in February and March, there was an alternate transition plan that the opposition finally came up with, the opposition essentially to the Islamists. And it would have meant forming a presidency council and then writing a constitution first and then going to election. Now, that plan itself, I don't think, was exactly workable. Who's going to be writing a constitution if you haven't had any elections and therefore have no idea who's going to be who the people would sort of pick as their representatives for any kind of constituent assembly? But the idea of taking ultimate authority away from the military and putting it in the hands of some kind of consensual body, I think, would have been very, very healthy. I think the idea of writing a constitution through a consensual process was also one that would have been healthy. That said, the reason you didn't get that kind of outcome, I think, had to do with suspicions on all sides. Those people who called for what they said was Constitution first were very frank about the fact that they wanted to postpone elections because they thought the Islamists would win them. Well, by making that kind of claim, they telegraphed very quickly to the Islamists that our plan is not about simply about a consensual process. Our plan is about limiting your influence. And it became very difficult to come to any kind of agreement in that kind of atmosphere. The Islamists, for their own part, I think as they realized the extent to which they were simply better suited to hold elections, also became much less willing to compromise. So you have this process in 2011 of kind of growing suspicions on both sides, and both sides think that they're playing by essentially fair rules, and the other side is cheating.
Now, we've discussed kind of the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Islamists, at least in general, the military angle, but something that is unclear is what kind of became of the opposition that showed up that was originally responsible for Mubarak's ouster. You write that, quote, when the decades-old Mubarak regime perished in the sudden and spectacular crash of early 2011, the triumphant revolutionaries found themselves beholding the records of a shattered authoritarian presidency with no shared platform and no authoritative structures to guide them beyond those needed to hammer out communiques from Tahrir Square. So why has the creation of that kind of shared platform proven so elusive to the Egyptian opposition?
Well, there's a couple things that was going on with the leadership of the revolution in Tahrir Square. Number one, they were able to coalesce essentially around negative demands. Irhal, get out, or the people want to follow the regime. But it was a very broad and diverse coalition. And in a sense, in order to get everybody on board, they postponed all those kinds of issues. I think a second thing was that an awful lot of the ethos of the leadership of this revolution was really, in a sense, anti-politics, anti-political. What they were about was about making Egypt into a very different kind of society. And they weren't necessarily interested in doorbelling and leafleting for candidates or running for office and therefore, doing things like constituent service and that sort of thing. These were movements and leaders who really saw themselves as about something beyond normal politics. And as a result, they simply didn't focus so much on elections. And there was a third problem as well. When the revolution began in late January, the Islamists basically were ambivalent about it. They felt that if they, and especially the Muslim Brotherhood, the Brotherhood, of course, opposed the Mubarak regime and was anxious to see some kind of political change in Egypt. But they also thought that the revolutionaries were a little bit too willing to take risks. The Brotherhood could expose itself to enormous repression if it joined into a revolutionary coalition and that revolution was suppressed. So the Brotherhood was very ambivalent. When it was clear after a couple days that these demonstrations had galvanized the Egyptian population into action, the Brotherhood came on board. At that point, you had an even more diverse revolutionary coalition, leftists, nationalists, youth activists, anti-political people, and now Islamists were entering the fray. And again, they could agree on a few things. They wanted Mubarak out. They wanted a more democratic political system. They wanted more accountability in political life. And they had a little bit of a history to draw on of talks in the pre-2011 period between various liberal and leftist and radical and Islamist groups where they basically sort of tried to reach across their ideological divides and try to understand and hammer out joint platforms. But that process was basically just embryonic. What it meant was that they knew how to speak each other's language, but they really hadn't come to any kind of understanding on fundamental rules of the political game. So in a sense, that revolutionary coalition triumphed a little bit too easily. They didn't have to hammer out anything more than that. And then essentially when Mubarak left and fell with surprising ease, all of a sudden they had different conceptions about what the proper process was, with the Islamists interested in elections and the revolutionaries interested in continuing the revolution.
Now, fast forward to the present, and we're reading stories now about the Muslim Brotherhood essentially being extinguished by the Egyptian, I'm not sure if it's the Interior Ministry. Could you speak a bit about this crackdown and how substantial it is and what it means for the future of that organization?
It's very substantial. And yes, it's not just the Interior Ministry, it's the judiciary, it's the religious establishment and so forth and so on. It was clear on June 30th that when the demonstrators turned out, June 30th of this year, that Morsi was in serious trouble, would probably be overthrown. And then on July 3rd, the military deposed him. What was less clear was what was going to happen to the Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood, in a sense, dug in its heels and said, Morsi is the legitimate president. And the new power brokers in Egypt decided to turn on the Brotherhood with a ferocity that actually took me a little bit by surprise. They have basically arrested almost all of the top leadership of the Brotherhood. They've now dismantled the Brotherhood as a non-governmental organization. It had recently finally achieved legal status. The Freedom and Justice Party, the Brotherhood's political party, has basically been decimated. It's not clear whether it continued in legal operation. Any official that had been appointed by the Brotherhood has basically been dismissed. Even some judges who had formed a front kind of within the judiciary that was more sympathetic to the Brotherhood, even they are being threatened with loss of their position. And on top of this is, I would say, a widespread media campaign against the Brotherhood, denouncing the organization as terrorists, a widespread campaign by the security services to suppress any kind of Brotherhood demonstrations, and really a public mood that enables this media campaign, this military action, the court cases, the purge of the Brotherhood, and the very, very rough suppression, which you've got over 1,000 deaths so far. In that kind of atmosphere, I think the Brotherhood is simply reeling as an organization. Its top leadership is not simply in jail, but is held incommunicado, and various leaders can't communicate with each other. So I think that what we're witnessing right now is the extinguishing of a political project that the Brotherhood had slowly built up over the last generation of trying to establish itself as a kind of regular player on Egypt's political scene. Where the Brotherhood goes from here, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure the Brotherhood itself knows at this point, but it's clear that whatever kind of political system emerges in Egypt right now, it's going to be one in which the Brotherhood is not really going to be an accepted political actor, at least in the short term.
Will Islamists be accepted political actors, the Nur Party, for example?
That's a great question, and the answer is not yet quite clear. When the military overthrew Morsi, the Nur Party did throw itself behind the coup, and it did so very clearly as an attempt to keep those elements of the 2012 Constitution, which it had helped secure the previous year. It did so also, I think, to retain its legal status, and it did so, in a sense, I think, as part of its own strategy, the Salafi strategy, of gradually Islamizing Egypt kind of from below. And they felt as long as they could keep some kind of formal presence and protected presence in Egypt's life, they could drag the society along through gradual persuasion. And in fact, they could probably even move into areas of Egyptian society where the Brotherhood had previously been dominant. Essentially, Salafis could take over the Brotherhood's role as dominating the Islamist side of the spectrum. That seemed to be their hope back in July. At this point, it's clear that they're not going to get very much in this new constitution, the 2013 constitution. The Islamic provisions they fought so hard for, I think, are going to be cut. But they may be able to salvage their legal status. They may be able to move into the areas, as I said, where the Brotherhood used to operate. So the Salafis will probably come out of this as a political actor that other sides have to take into account in their own calculations. But it's unlikely to be the kind of major player that I think they thought they were going to be when Morsi was overthrown back in July.
Okay, Professor Brown, final question, and then we'll let you off the hook. So the State Department has recently issued a press release indicating that it will, quote, continue to hold the delivery of certain large-scale military systems and cash assistance to the Egyptian government pending credible progress toward an inclusive, democratically elected civilian government through free and fair elections. Now, General al-Sisi has responded by intimating, in a sense, that Egypt may be compelled to seek assistance elsewhere. Does this augur some change in kind of the balance in the Middle East?
I don't think it augurs a fundamental change. The leadership in Egypt and the leadership in the United States, I think, still see each other as actors that the other has to do business with. The United States is clearly uncomfortable with a lot of the events that have taken place in Egypt over the past couple months. And I think they're worried about Egypt's democratic credentials and the democratic credentials of the political system that is emerging. But even more than that, they're worried that the political system that is emerging will not be a stable one. So a lot of the concern has to do, I think, with the transition process in Egypt, that it seems to be going not simply in an undemocratic direction, but perhaps in an unstable one as well. And yet, ultimately, the American-Egyptian relationship is so deep. It is a partnership that dates back to the Nixon administration. It is one that has many different levels. So that fundamentally, I think what we'll see is an America that kind of comes to terms with a new regime in Egypt, but grumbles about it. And you'll see tension creep into the relationship, or you've already seen great degrees of tension creep into the relationship. From the Egyptian side, I think there are similar kinds of there's a similar kind of calculus. There is a tremendous suspicion of the United States among Egyptians, and a sense that the United States was responsible even for the Morsi victory, the Morsi presidency, and the Brotherhood's rise, and that the United States stood silent in front of what are now perceived as abuses by Morsi and by the Brotherhood. And yet the military leadership in particular, which is going to be in a very, very powerful position in security and foreign policy, has a close partnership with the United States military in terms of its equipment, in terms of its training, and I don't think wants to burn that bridge. So they're clearly resentful of the United States, but I don't think that they're going to push for a total break.
Well, we appreciate your insights. Our guest has been Professor Nathan Brown. He's the author of Egypt's Failed Transition, which appears in the October 2013 issue of the Journal of Democracy. That is available as a free download at journalofdemocracy.org. And once again, Professor Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.